This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
Hello, Greg Jenner here. I'm the host of You're Dead to Me, the BBC comedy show that takes history seriously. Every episode, I pair up a top historian with a fantastic comedian, and we have a lovely, funny, fascinating chat about a different subject from world history. And in this new series, we're beginning with an epic voyage through the story of Homer, the Iliad, and the Odyssey. And that's with Kyle Smith-Bino joining us. And then we'll be learning about Francis Galton and the racist, discredited pseudoscience of eugenics with Desiree Birch. We'll meet many medieval saints in their bone boxes with Rachel Parrott. So if that sounds like your sort of thing, listen to You're Dead to Me wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you. Bye.
BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
If you'd forgotten about the war in Ukraine, then this week's appearance of drones over the Kremlin will have reminded you that the biggest armed conflict in Europe since the Second World War continues. Winter has passed, spring is here, and President Volodymyr Zelensky says the Ukrainian counteroffensive is close. Is it? If it is, what is its objective? Is it likely to succeed? And if it does succeed, what then? Step inside the briefing room and together we'll find out. First, what's the situation on the ground? Michael Clarke is Professor of Defence Studies at King's College London and Specialist Advisor to the Joint Committee on the National Security Strategy. When I last spoke to him on the briefing room in January, he told me that both sides were digging in for winter. So what's happened in the last 4 months? But first, I had to ask him what his theory is about those drones.
Well, I'd be astonished if Kiev created this event, because it would be monumentally stupid of Kiev to do that. And in fact, looking at the forensic material that we're aware of now, there were two drones about 16 minutes apart. The first one came from the west and struck above the dome at 2:27 in the morning, created some burning, which didn't seem to do very much damage. And then 16 minutes later, at 2:43, a second drone from the east came and went past the dome and then seemed to explode or at least glow. I mean, that's what we know for certain. We also know for certain that the Moscow air defense system, it's a Pantsir system. There are three overlapping circles around Moscow and they all overlap completely over the Kremlin. So it's a very strong system. And we know that the Kremlin has ways of completely blanking out any electronic material going past it. And so it, again, seems very unlikely that drones like this could have found their way to a target like that using GPS or other forms of navigation. So it makes it more likely that they were a line of sight device, but we just don't know. And the idea that they've said today that the Americans were behind it just makes it even more silly. I mean, these drones to me are a firework display more than anything else. And if they have a strategic effect, it will be because Russia wants them to have a strategic effect, even though it is embarrassing for the Kremlin to have a couple of devices fly over and explode in some way. I don't believe Kiev did it. I'd be amazed if they did. I don't really think it's a false flag operation by Russia because it is embarrassing. And why would they do that? There are any number of opposition groups in Russia. The Rospartisan group have already said this was a righteous fire. They issued a statement, you know, identifying at least with the spirit behind the drones. There are groups in Belarus. My guess is that this will be a freelance operation with very crude technology. And the Russians will get over their embarrassment by making out that it's some sort of major escalation from Kiev.
Michael, when we spoke in early January, we asked you how the war might evolve in 2023. The Ukrainians had recaptured Kherson, I think, that autumn. And you said essentially both sides were digging in for the winter. Now, what's happened on the ground in the 4 months since we spoke?
Since the winter, the Russians have begun to push on most of the fronts in the Donbass. I don't think that's the totality of the Russian offensive, but they're certainly pushed from the north, from Kupiansk and Svatove and Kramina, towards the south of that area, towards Advika and Vuhledar. They've also been artillery shelling down in the west against Kherson itself. They're the other side of the Dnieper River, but they've been shelling the city of Kherson that they withdrew from in late November. Meanwhile, the Ukrainians have been holding their new forces back, the forces that they've got from the West. They've been holding back the new numbers that they have recruited. They've got about 12 new brigades. They're putting something like 80 or 90,000 new troops into the field. But the Ukrainians have been not losing too much territory in the last couple of months, holding with what they've got, even though the units on the front line, some of them are not very experienced and they've not got very good equipment and they've not got very much ammunition. They all complain about that. But the strategy in Kyiv is certainly to lose as little amount of territory as possible until their counteroffensive is ready, which it now appears almost to be. It will begin when the weather allows it to be most effective.
We were talking back in January about the heavy fighting in Bakhmut. What's happened there? Do the Ukrainians still hold it?
I think the Ukrainians, in effect, have lost Bakhmut, but they don't have to admit that as long as there is one road open. And the road that is open, and this is the road of the war so far, it's the T-0504 that goes from Bakhmut to the southwest towards Konstantinivka. And as long as that road is open, then the Ukrainians can claim that Bakhmut has not fallen. They're holding a sliver, a real sliver of the old urban area. And that road is under artillery fire. Both sides are fighting over control of that road. And until the Ukrainians lose control of it, they do not have to admit that they've effectively lost Bakhmut. But in every practical sense, they have. But what I think they're doing is they're desperately holding on until their offensive begins, and then whatever happens in Bakhmut will not be relevant. The Russians will not have the propaganda victory of being able to say that they've taken Bakhmut. And I think if they can hold for another 10 days or 2 weeks, then they will have held long enough, because the Ukrainian offensive may well then be underway.
What have events more recently in the last few weeks told us, both about the possibility of a Ukrainian offensive and Russian strategy?
The Ukrainian offensive is real. And it hasn't begun yet. And when it does begin, I think we'll see a return of more mobile armored warfare on both sides. We know that, according to NATO, the Ukrainians have now received more than 200 main battle tanks from the West and 1,550 armored vehicles of various sorts. What we don't know is how well the Ukrainians have integrated these together into armored brigades. Now, there's enough tanks there for at least two armored brigades, and that sounds impressive. But remember, the front between Russia and Ukraine, the fighting front, is 1,000 kilometers long. Two armored brigades, powerful though they would be, though they would punch through probably anything the Russians have got, would only give you a front of about 50 or 60 kilometers in a 1,000-kilometer front line. And so what would that be like? I mean, the optimists say, well, if they punch through, then Russian forces would collapse elsewhere. It might even cause a crisis within Russia itself and a crisis for Putin. But more skeptical people say, well, actually, it would be like punching through a sponge. Even if the Russians were penetrated on the front line quite deeply, they'll just come back with more because they don't care about losses. They'll just feed more forces in, they'll feed more troops in, and you won't be able to create any decisive breakthroughs, even though militarily you might walk straight through some of the Russian front lines. We don't know which of those views is right, the optimistic or the pessimistic view, but I suspect we're going to find out probably by the end of June.
Michael Clark. Now to analyse the thinking in Kyiv. Joining me in the briefing room is BBC journalist Vitaly Shevchenko, co-presenter of the Ukrainecast podcast. Vitaly, at the top of the programme, Michael Clark told us his theory that the drone strike on the Kremlin was most likely carried out by Russian dissidents, because that's the best explanation as far as he can see. What's your take?
Well, it's one theory, but still there are more questions than answers in this case. If there is a group of dissidents within Russia which is capable of carrying this out, it's a very, very secret group, because by now, President Putin has succeeded in eliminating almost completely and entirely whatever remnants of the opposition there were within Russia. If it was the Ukrainians, as the Kremlin claims, how did they do it? How did they manage to penetrate all these air defenses that Russia, you would think, has around its seat of power, the Kremlin, which is surely one of the, if not the most tightly guarded place in Russia? if it wasn't the Ukrainians, why would the Kremlin carry out a false flag operation and blame it on Ukraine? Does it really need a pretext to carry out some kind of atrocity in Ukraine that it hasn't done already? One thing that Russia, as far as we know, has not yet done in Ukraine is targeting President Zelensky's offices. So looking at what Russian media and Russian commentators are saying, they are quite literally demanding blood. They're saying that President Zelensky needs to be eliminated. This is what the Speaker of the Russian Parliament said. They will demand the use of weapons which can destroy, and I quote, the terrorist regime in Kyiv. So it's not exactly clear who did it, but the potential ramifications can be huge.
Now, let's look at President Zelensky. He's been on the move. He was in Finland yesterday. He's in The Hague today. What's going on?
Well, he's on a tour to drum up more support for Ukraine and Ukraine's fight against Russia. The timing, again, is interesting. When the Kremlin was allegedly hit, Zelensky was out of Ukraine. So if Russia were to try and get him, they would want to do it not in Ukraine, but elsewhere. But that's just me speculating. In terms of what President Zelensky's objectives are, they've obviously undergone a transformation. He's not talking about peace as much as he used to. He's talking about victory now, because he's emboldened by all the support that he's getting from the West and from the public at home. And his ultimate stated objective is restoring Ukraine's borders to where they were back in 1991, when Ukraine declared independence from the USSR, which, of course, means retaking territories which Russia had captured before the full-scale invasion last year. And the public in Ukraine would accept nothing less from him. Anything short of that objective would be seen as cowardice and defeatism, while the public discourse in Ukraine and discussions within the expert community have been focused on this expected Ukrainian counter-offensive.
Vitaly, let me be clear about this. This is not the question of Zelensky trying to lead a reluctant Ukrainian people towards what he thinks victory should be. This is a question of the Ukrainian people very possibly saying to Zelensky, we won't accept anything less than this as an objective.
I think this is more likely to be driven from bottom up, if you like. If you look at the latest opinion polls in Ukraine, President Zelensky's trust ratings are skyrocketing, 85%, the latest figure is, which is more than President Putin's ratings in Russia, according to Russia's official opinion pollsters. So this suggests that this kind of rhetoric of we want all of Ukraine territories back, this rhetoric enjoys wide public support within Ukraine. And even the people who are trailing Zelensky in opinion polls, they have broadly similar views, and pro-Russian figures, they are in the single digits in terms of trust ratings. So there's clearly a public consensus in Ukraine centered around fighting and defeating Russia and taking everything back, including Crimea and parts of Donbass occupied by Russia currently. Of course, this is a monumental challenge, but that's what the public in Ukraine wants. Of course, it comes at a price. There's no way to hide the human cost of what's going on. Of course, there are huge numbers of people in Ukraine who just want this to be over. But they realize that what is happening now, it just can't suddenly stop. And there's no trust within Ukraine, and I mean both the public in Ukraine and officials in Ukraine, that if, for the sake of the argument, Russia were to stop fighting and declare a ceasefire of some sort, there's no trust that it will not resume attacks on Ukraine as soon as it can. So all this means that there's a public push towards fighting Russia, and defeating it wherever Ukraine can defeat Russia.
Vitaly Shevchenko. And you can get more regular insights from Vitaly on Ukrainecast, which is available to download on BBC Sounds. Speaking of which, a quick reminder that you can subscribe to the podcast of our programme by visiting BBC Sounds, and you'll get access to the entire back catalogue, including last week's on the origin of the crisis in Sudan, the one about whether we should worry about the AI revolution, and the one about the many legal woes of Donald Trump. But now, back to the war in Ukraine. Joining me is Tomila Lankina, Professor of Politics and International Relations at LSE, who's currently writing a book about the history of dissent in Russia. Tomila Lankina, what have you made of the Kremlin's explanation of the drone attack the other day?
I think they're absolutely preposterous because most people know that Putin doesn't actually work or live in the Kremlin. There is a lot of speculation about the kind of extra precautions that he takes to avoid being in the public eye, to isolate himself from any kind of normal human contact with other people because of his concerns for his own safety and security. And so this idea that Ukraine would not be aware of this, considering the superior intelligence that they have, that it would sort of make Ukrainians look very, very bad if they indeed seriously contemplated mounting an attack of this kind. So I'm very much in the camp of people who kind of regard it as an attempted false flag operation.
Do you think, very briefly, that ordinary Russians will accept the idea that it was an assassination attempt, or will themselves be sceptical?
Well, many Russians undoubtedly will accept this, and the Russian state-controlled television channels have been full of allegations of how this will not be left without a robust response from Russia. They're now talking about targeting Zelensky. Many Russians do still derive most of their news from these official sources, and they do trust them. However, it has become very, very difficult to gauge the actual extent of citizen awareness of what is actually going on because of the mass manipulation of public opinion and propaganda that has just gotten really much worse over the last year and a half.
Now, given the difficulties you're describing, can we tell anything about how the attitude of ordinary Russians to the war itself might be changing?
So many Russians actually thought that the war probably is not something that is directly impacting them in the first weeks or even months of the war. However, we know that the body count has been going up very, very dramatically. And as more and more ordinary Russians experience the war, as the war is basically coming into their living rooms, coming into their families because their loved ones are being conscripted, more and more people find out about the war, especially the most poor, vulnerable, socioeconomically deprived people. So those faraway places that might not be massively exposed to news on the internet or Twitter and all of that, they actually learn about the war because the tragedy comes to their own house.
Now, being affected is not the same thing as then opposing. Can you measure whether or not the effect upon citizens is in any way pushing people towards a more sceptical or oppositionist view of the war?
I would say it is sceptical, but it is still very, very difficult for people to make that stand. In the regime, over the last year, the parliamentary printing presses have been absolutely raving with laws passed to penalize any kind of dissent. You know, families are being torn apart. There are denunciations. There are treason laws. Political opposition activists like Vladimir Karamurza, who's very brave, have suffered two assassination attempts. He's been sentenced to 25 years in prison. And people are aware of that. And so my own brother, he had been protesting in Moscow a few times, but even he's keeping low, and as many people are now in Russia, because they know what the consequences are.
Let's move on from looking at the Russian people themselves to looking at the leadership. As you understand it, as of now, what does victory look like for Vladimir Putin?
I think by now he's probably realized that there's not going to be the victory that he saw in his fantasies. Putin and the people around him are looking for face-saving strategies, such as peace negotiations. Let's have negotiations with Zelensky about, you know, a peace settlement. And the propaganda machinery, they have been peddling these narratives of if only Ukraine would agree to sit down for peace. And there are many even Western experts and analysts who kind of swallow and accept that it's a reasonable approach. Well, it isn't. It's naive pacifism, because what Russia is clamoring for is to keep Crimea, the Donbas territories, and for Ukrainian people, understandably, these are non-negotiable positions.
So your observation is that Putin thinks that victory still looks like maintaining hold of the territories that Russia has effectively occupied so far, and that that is something that if he could get it, he would now settle for.
Absolutely. And we know that there's increasingly fissures around him within his own inner circle, and they're increasingly voicing concerns with how poorly the Russian army has been supplied, the rates of casualties, which is why, for instance, we find bizarre situations of battle for Bakhmut and really not progressing very much. It's all about face saving.
Now, we've heard the prediction already in this program that Ukraine will launch a counteroffensive. If that counteroffensive is broadly successful, in other words, it does push the Russian army and military forces out of more territory in Ukraine, what impact do you think that's likely to have on Putin's leadership?
I think we are witnessing increasingly evidence of disillusionment within his inner circle. And I cannot predict, I don't have a crystal ball, but some kind of a palace coup or even some element of warlordism whereby people in the, you know, security might be staging something to depose the leader who has clearly not delivered. As far as the hawks are concerned, and certainly people who are liberal and people who abhorred this war in the first place, they would be very pleased to see Putin go.
To Mila Lankina. Right, now to Ukraine's backers in the West and the quest for an end to the war. My final guest in the briefing room is Dr. Leslie Vinjamuri, director of the US and the Americas program at Chatham House. Leslie Vinjamuri, since January, have there been any trends in Western support for Ukraine? Has it altered in any way?
There was a real feeling in the winter that the American public, people across Europe, might begin to feel like it was hopeless, that they wanted to see a solution, and that this might, you know, really pull away the support that European and American leaders were giving to the war. Now, there have certainly been moments where we've seen certain Republican leaders play politics, but surprisingly, it hasn't worked. The support, you know, for a war that is well into its second year now has been surprisingly strong. Here in the U.S., where I am now, we've seen one of the biggest naysayers of American support for the war, you know, basically lose his job. Tucker Carlson, coming off Fox News, is probably one of the most significant developments when it comes to securing a more sustained U.S. support for supporting Ukraine.
Has there been any evolution in thinking amongst the policymaking classes about what winning should or could look like?
What we're hearing in the public domain is certainly quite a lot different than the conversation that they're having behind closed doors about where this might eventually end up. The most surprising fact to many has been how weak Russia and how poorly Russia has performed, how badly it has miscalculated. But it's equally clear that, you know, the end result is uncertain, that it's quite far off, that there could be some very difficult decisions to be made. But that conversation is still not really taking place in the public domain. There's still an emphasis on supporting Ukraine. The U.S. on Wednesday, the Pentagon just announced another $300 million worth of aid that would be sent to Ukraine. That brings the U.S. total military aid to about $36 billion, to use the old language of peace diplomacy and negotiations. There's not a sense right now that this is a conflict that's ripe for negotiation.
One of the interesting developments has been the appearance on the scene of President Xi Jinping and him speaking to Zelensky, to Volodymyr Zelensky on the phone for the first time in more than a year. What do we know about what the Chinese are hoping to do there?
China doesn't have a sustained interest in having an unstable situation in Ukraine. And I see this very much as part of China's desire to shore up its global reputation, to send some signals that it's on the right side of peace. Obviously, there's been a lot of legitimate concern about China's no-limits friendship with Russia. The West has been watching very carefully to see whether China would be providing lethal aid to Russia. And so I think when we look at that phone call, we look at Xi's interactions with Zelensky, it's a symbolic measure. It's a signaling that China does have some interest in peace, that China would like to be seen as a peace diplomat on a global stage. But I think at some deeper level, there's still a feeling that China has not held the line with Russia, that it's not an equal partner to Ukraine and Russia. And so I think there's deep skepticism coming out of Europe and the U.S. But, you know, the fact that there's been a conversation is certainly important, and it potentially lays a framework for what might come.
Now, there is another clock ticking here, and that's the clock that's ticking in America itself. There will be a presidential election in 2024. How worried should President Zelensky be about the possibility of a defeat for President Biden?
Well, first of all, we don't know who the Republican candidate is. If it's Donald Trump, were that to take place, if Donald Trump were to emerge as the president, that I think would actually be quite a significant game changer in terms of America's support. We know Donald Trump has had a very specific position on Russia. He's been friendly with Putin. He's been an outlier, not only in American politics, he's been an outlier in his own party. And I think many of us have been concerned that the Trump wing of the Republican Party would pull back its support. And we're even seeing DeSantis, the governor in Florida, who seemed to be potentially a major challenger to Donald Trump. But we're even seeing DeSantis hew to the line very strongly if he supports Ukraine in its war with Russia.
Leslie, finally, do you think that there's a sense in the West now that policymakers have accepted that brokering a peace deal is not in our gift?
I think that this is a question of timing. And we are seeing the most phenomenal array of would-be peace brokers, from Saudi Arabia to China to Macron in France to the United States implicitly. And, you know, everybody would like to play this role. They'd like to have a stake in the future of Ukraine. There's certainly benefits for Saudi Arabia and Ukraine. There's a big question of who's going to pay the bill for reconstruction. But yes, I think those that are most clearly behind the defense of Ukraine recognize that this is a question of timing, and the timing has not yet arrived.
Leslie Vinjamuri, my thanks to her and to Michael Clark, Vitaly Shevchenko and to Mila Lankina. And my conclusion is the obvious one, I suppose. The offensive seems imminent, and although it won't end the war, it may very well decide how the war does eventually end. We at The Briefing Room will be back at the same time next week. You've been listening to The Briefing Room with me, David Aronovich. The producers were Ben Carter, Kirsty Knight and Claire Bowes. The editor was Penny Murphy, and the programme was mixed by James Beard. Another edition of this podcast will be along again soon.
Hello, my name's Michelle De Swart.
And I'm Laura Smith. And we have a new podcast from BBC Radio 4.
Bang On It is a weekly podcast where we curate, recommend, cherry pick through the week and just go, have a look at that,
basically.
We're going highbrow, we're going lowbrow, right?
We're doing the legs, we're doing the hard yards so you don't have to.
Oh, I like that.
Listen, like all podcasts, we're talking about stuff we've done, whether you should bother doing it, but really we're waxing lyrical and
trying to make that paper, baby. The economy's in the pan.
Subscribe to Bang On It on BBC Sounds.
Hello. Hello, Greg Jenner here. I'm the host of You're Dead to Me, the BBC comedy show that takes history seriously. Every episode, I pair up a top historian with a fantastic comedian, and we have a lovely, funny, fascinating chat about a different subject from world history. And in this new series, we're beginning with an epic voyage through the story of Homer, the Iliad, and the Odyssey. And that's with Kyle Smith-Bino joining us. And then we'll be learning about Francis Galton and the racist, discredited pseudoscience of eugenics with Desiree Birch. We'll meet many medieval saints in their bone boxes with Rachel Parrott. So if that sounds like your sort of thing, listen to You're Dead to Me wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you. Bye.